like I said, if I would have been a less honest person, I could have made, you know, in that instance, it was $500,000. That was a remote code execution that would have worked on a thing called a session border control. And that effect, that would have affected, you know, probably 70% of the voice traffic. So people wouldn't have been able to listen to pretty much phone calls. They would have been able to get into these telecom networks and things like that. And they should just need to make it easier for people to be able to disclose those kind of vulnerabilities. So.
Welcome to Risk Matters X.0. My name is Ian Bramson. I am the head of cybersecurity for ABS Group. And today I'm speaking with Weston Hecker with MSI. He's a principal, Application Security Group. And today we're taking the hacker's point of view for ship and maritime cybersecurity. So what we're doing today is trying to look at what cybersecurity looks like from the opposition or the red team's point of view. Weston, thank you and for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Could you just tell us a little bit about, first of all, your background and what you do with MSI, and then we'll get into the topic.
Yeah, I've worked for MSI for about 4 years. I met him at a conference where I was talking about hacking oil rigs, so it was right up their alley. And been doing pen testing professionally for, this is my 17th year. I've spoken at DEF CON 6 times, Black Hat, HOPE, just 62 other conventions, over 1,300 security projects, tons of CVEs or common vulnerabilities and huge brands of software, Microsoft, Qualcomm, Samsung, Verizon. You know, I started out programming when I was about 11, got into reverse engineering, you know, cracking video games and stuff like that, and got into exploit development in the early 2000s, in the heyday of hacking back before you can get paid for it. So, and just been doing pen testing 17 years and do everything from, I focused in telecom for about 3 years, went to oil rigs, military vehicles, airplanes, trains, airports, offshore oil rigs, oil tankers. So I do a lot of the weird stuff that not a lot of other pen testers do, or what we'd call classical pen testing. So,
well, let's talk about that for a second. So you're what we call a white hat hacker, which is someone who is an ethical hacker who actually goes in and tries to attack a ship from a cybersecurity perspective and then gives a report out to customers. So you hack professionally. And, yep. And it looks like you've been doing it for a while. So tell us a little bit more about the concept of pen testing. When someone gives this to you, an assignment, how do you break that down? When they say, okay, go, there's a ship, go get into it. How does that actually work?
Yeah. That's another thing too, is it's kind of a new testing in the industry. You know, 5 years ago, people were pen testing, but they weren't necessarily pen testing, you know, oil and gas or some of the industrial control systems that are actually on ships. Because, you know, we barely had enough engineers to fill the positions, nonetheless, pen testers that understood how to break those same positions. So, yeah, it's something that, just over the years, we've had companies that have reached out and I basically am contracted to find the vulnerabilities before the bad guys do and then tell them how to fix it. So, and it's using, a lot of the custom tools that are developed, you know, are home-built radio systems using like field programmable arrays and like advanced pieces of technology that didn't even exist 10 years ago. So I can program a software-defined radio to pick up the diagnostic stuff on some Caterpillar engine on a ship.
Wow. So, okay. So let's talk about a little bit about the hacker's point of view, or the bad guys, in this case, the black hat hackers or the bad guys' point of view. You have to get into their mindset. When they're looking at this, if you put it through their eyes, why attack a ship? What's the motivation to go and do it in the first place?
Yeah. There's a couple of people that are kind of threat actors. There's the nation states, you know, China, countries that are, you know, at war with one another. You know, if country X is with country Y, they can attack one another's. There's examples of that with the enrichment of uranium, just production in general, electricity, oil and gas. Obviously, you know, if they're bread and butter for their, actual products that they develop, if you can impact those production lines and things along that, you can actually cost money. There's hackers, black hat hackers. Those are the bad guys. Those are the ones that, you know, took the path less that Weston didn't, but it's definitely something that, say, for example, if they can hack into, you know, company X and they can buy a put option against a stock, or, you know, if they can hold the data ransom or if they can, you know, get proprietary information and sell it. That's one other kind of hackers. There's protesters. A lot of the energy companies that I consult for, they have protesters and what are called hacktivists, which is like a spin on the word activists. And they're actually going after, you know, oil-filled pipelines. They're going after, you know, like anything, pretty much anything that's not renewable energy. So any of the old coal companies, things like that. So then you have your bored 12-year-olds in Belgium that you have to deal with also. So are the script kiddies and people that aren't, you know, classically trained in hacking, just, you know, they do it for boredom or for the challenge of it. So, and that's a majority of the, you know, the actual attack vectors from the actual threat actors. So,
yeah. And I'll tell you, when we're out there also talking to customer and we're doing our penetration testing, we get asked that question a lot. And the conversation also starts to turn to how that those intrusions or how those exploits have changed from just doing from the IT side. What everyone knows, their computers, their phones, the stuff at the enterprise level, meaning at HQ. And then when it starts actually going aboard vessel. And what we're seeing a lot is that's getting into what we call the operational technology or the industrial cyber side. And when you get in there, the game's all different from what we're seeing. Now you're not just stealing data, you're having kinetic effects. You're shutting stuff down, you're blowing stuff up. And, we're seeing a lot of that being the motivation. When you have kinetic effects, it's a lot bigger prize because this now becomes not only operational risk, which is what you said, right? I can slow stuff down. I can delay stuff, which can cost millions of dollars, but it's also a safety issue, right? I can do it aboard vessel safety. I can do it in environmental safety or public safety. Mm-hmm. So the impact now changes. And it changes that motivational structure to get these in. When you're looking at these, and you're taking that in, what is the process you would go through, or what are the kinds of ways you would think about typically trying to break into something like a ship?
Yeah, there's three. You know, I've done several penetration tests on actual vessels out at sea. You know, for a variety of companies and. There were three or four different main ways that I actually got into the vessels or the ships. One of them was through the home office, you know, actually going through the guest network, onto the voice network, and then, you know, into the actual business network, into the IT network, and then out to the ships using some of their satellite links or ones that have 24-hour communication. I've also found vulnerabilities in site-to-site microwave hops, which are basically, you know, N365, you know, different open spectrum radio waves that they use to communicate with offshore platforms. So actually taking that technology, it's kind of like their internet service provider, but actually, you know, finding weaknesses in the way that they provision their services and things along those lines. So you can actually attack multiple ships in that instance. Some of the other methods, with one of the antennas that I have, it's a high gain antenna, and I can do from about a quarter mile away from a ship. I can actually start hacking any 802.11 or wireless communications. So in addition to, you know, the offices, and, you know, actually being physically near it, if you can get within a quarter mile of those ships, yes, they are, you know, relatively a Faraday cage because, you know, it's a large chunk of metal usually. So wireless can't reach as far as usual, but it's definitely something from, you know, even a quarter mile away, or having a stowaway device even put on the device, or, you know, put on the actual, say, for example, some of those you know, ships or the offshore oil rigs, you can only fly out to them with a helicopter. So if somebody was to place, you know, a device on the helicopter or things along those lines, and then also you have employees that bring USB devices, that overlaps a little bit with classical penetration testing and things along those lines. So, and it does fall in with a lot of the classical spear phishing emails, things along those lines.
Well, then you bring up a real great point. Look, what we often come across when we're speaking with customers is, gee, we're not all that connected. We're out in the middle of the ocean, or we only have one SATCOM link, and they use a concept of air gapping, meaning their stuff is all scrolled away and nothing can touch it. What would you say to that, given what you just said about the different varieties of ways getting in, about the connectivity and ways in?
Yeah, the only difference between that and a satellite connection is, instead of, you know, 82 milliseconds of latency or slow internet or fast internet, they're going to have a little bit a slower process of doing it. So it's still possible to do, you know, you on most of the ships that I've been on, you know, 1800 millisecond latency, you could almost play online games with that. So it is.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty efficient.
And we talk about things like vendor risk management, because again, when they're in port and they have different types of vendors coming on board, there's very little visibility. About
locked.
Yeah, exactly. And then even the you know, people have their iPhones, they want to plug it in, so they put it on their iPhone, and the iPhone they plug into the USB port to plug it in, even though they're not supposed to do that. You're getting those types of elements and penetrations going in that front. How long does it take to hack into a ship typically?
My quickest one was about 15 minutes. So I asked the employee for the password just to hop on and get stuff, and by the time he got back, I had access. So
wow, 15 minutes. That's pretty good. I think ours that we heard of is 8 minutes, and it was through a offshore place, and it was through a printer.
Oh, printer, yeah.
A wireless printer. So yeah,
that's a huge attack vector. Like I've used printers to get onto business networks, because basically once you take over that printer, you basically have a Linux machine running on that network. And then also, if they have it attached to the USB, I've actually, on a recent trip I did, I actually emulated a keyboard. So even though it wasn't connected to the network, it was still plugged in with the USB port. And I basically turned that printer into a USB or a USB keyboard or HID device, a human interface device. So I could basically send keystrokes, have it visit web pages, or things along those lines. So.
Wow. Well, so once, I mean, when we talk about control, what are we talking about? You get in, again, you're a bad guy, you get in there. How long are you in? Can you be in there? Because people think that one of the things we come across is, right, cyber attacks are instantaneous. It's within a millisecond of them getting in, they do something, which we find to be not obviously accurate as how much time they can actually spend in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Some of them, they'll sit and wait for an exploit to come out, even if people are fully patched. If somebody's able to obtain persistence inside the network, they're able to basically wait till a vulnerability comes out for something, or, you know, they're able to pivot into other networks and things like that. Like I've used battery backup devices that were plugged into, you know, both parts of a network to actually pivot from a business network into the actual controls on the ship in a couple instances. So it's stuff where, yeah, like once people are on the ship, you know, or have access to something on the ship or things along those lines, they can sit and wait for quite a while. They can collect proprietary information. Like the original oil rig hacking talk I did was actually a landman. He was basically stealing DST or drill stem test information from oil rigs around the area and seeing what was productive areas. So they were actually, it was like seeing into the future for all these wildcat wells or these exploratory wells. So if somebody would be able to, you know, tell how much of a payload is on a ship or things along those lines, it's just proprietary business information that can be used for financial gains. And not only that, if somebody, you know, was to run a crypto locker type scenario, like where they actually, you know, encrypt all the files, they can demand ransom when you're, you know, it's costing $1,600 a minute to sit out in the middle of the ocean or whatever the, you know, dollar amount comes down to. It's a pretty quick decision to, you know, pay ransoms in some cases. And yeah. And then wearing through, you know, devices, it's also, you know, wear and tear on machines through diagnostic systems and things along those lines. So,
yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And we've also seen larger pieces, you know, the concepts of if I can slow one fleet down, I have to turn them off, right? I don't have to shut them down. I can slow them down and then bet on the other guys. And now I'm manipulating either energy markets or other types of markets. So there's from the individual due diligence or the ways I can exploit. There's, again, you said the denial, meaning the ransomware, I'm going to lock stuff up and you're going to have to pay me to unlock it. There's just a lot of different ways. Are you seeing it becoming more frequent, less frequent when you're out there? As far as the types of attacks that are happening, is it something that's evolving?
Yeah, definitely. With the increase in speed in satellites and, you know, site-to-site communications for wireless, it's definitely becoming something, especially with everybody having their, you know, Internet of Things devices. Everybody has a smart light bulb or, you know, things like that, unnecessariness that needs to be plugged into a network. And just with, you know, the rise of a small computer in your pocket, you know, everybody has their iPhones or Android phones. So, yeah, the huge attack surface. And just with some of those, I've seen several proof of concepts where people, you know, are able to compromise an Android device, and then it basically goes around compromising everything it wirelessly comes into range with. So, yeah.
So break down a typical attack. So, okay, let's say you want to be able to take over the industrial system, an engine, let's say. Okay. And you want to be able to hold it, that engine, shut it down and hold it for ransom. Let's just say that's your motivation. And you're working for a organized crime outlet. So you're pretty well funded, right? You got the pieces, you're patient, you're well-trained. That's your profile. Yeah. What would be a basic way? I mean, I know there's many ways in, but just kind of break it down piece by piece. How would you get in or break in and exercise that kind of exploit?
Yeah, just from a standpoint of like how a person would go about, you know, getting devices onto a ship, things along those lines. There's always the insider threat. You know, some of the ships that I've been on, or they're, you know, they operate all over the world. Some people, you know, make, you know, $400 a month. You know, that's, you know, a daily salary for some of the US based people. So, you know, aside from insider threats, it would definitely be something while the ship was in port. Would use some sort of wireless device to either attack keyboards, mice, and either a wireless printer of some kind. So, like, you know, while they're in port, they're, you know, they're within that quarter mile range that I was talking about. And a lot of those systems are, you know, are set at a different phase than a normal system. So they become a little bit vulnerable when some of the systems are idled, or when, you know, when they are most likely running some kind of diagnostics. Or maintenance type modes and things like that. So basically what I would do is, you know, get a high gain antenna, take over a printer on the network, or, you know, start, you know, snooping out wireless devices with a lot of the wireless keyboards. Every single ship I've ever been on doing a pen test, I found vulnerable keyboards and mice for that matter. So you can basically pair with those Bluetooth devices, and you can actually hijack their inputs. So you can start actually snipping out keystrokes, seeing what people are typing, you know, then you collect passwords, usernames. So between those two wireless snooping aspects, I would basically snip out usernames and passwords. And then I would basically, once I had a printer on the network, I'd be able to log into most likely, you know, systems on the network, or just start attacking those other systems using common exploits. Because since those computers are out in the middle of the ocean, they don't get a patch Tuesday. Like the rest of the world does. So it's something where, you know, some of these devices I've seen, you know, haven't been patched since the ship was launched in 2016 and things along those lines. And you're talking thousands of vulnerabilities. So after I took over a printer, I would basically start moving in throughout the actual business portion of the network. And then I would start looking for that, like I was saying, that pivot point or something that has a dual connection. And
I just want to stop you there. So that when you say pivot point, that means you're going from one kind of network access to a different kind of network, and you're looking for that way to get from one spot to another. So maybe up from their IT side to their industrial side.
Correct. Yep. So basically I would go into their industrial control side. And there's been a couple times when I found actual printers that were hooked into the net, into the ICS network or the actual bridge. Like one comes to mind where there was a ship on the bridge of the ship. They were using it for a print server. So they basically had a wireless connection just for the printer. So it was something where they would connect to it once a day and print some stuff off. And then, it, you know, they wasn't connected to the network allegedly. So it's something where, you know, I would take over a device like that, and I would go into the, you know, the fuel propulsion systems or some of the ballasts or, you know, the specifics for the actual ship. And then at that point, you're talking, you know, several of those systems are Windows 7, if you're lucky. You know, I've seen several HMI or human machine interfaces that have Windows XP logos all over them. So, and with those, it is quite literally child's play to, you know, run some of the exploits against those.
Because they're left to, so if you got a Windows XP, they don't even make patches for those or anything like that anymore. So those vulnerabilities are just hanging out there. And we've seen the same thing. We've had scans and vulnerability tests and those types of things. And they've come to us and said, gee, I've got this Windows XP machine, but I can't really switch it out. So yeah. What do I do? And that's the kind of questions that we end up trying to handle and manage through. But they're in there, and they've been there for a while, and they're getting into that industrial level. So, okay, so now you're in there, you're banging around. One of the things that we have found, and one of the reasons why I wanted you to walk through this is when we talk about your pivot, is how what we call flat these networks are, meaning usually in an IT world, you're talking about a lot of what we call segmentation. You can only have limit to certain areas, and then it's hard to get from one to pivot, as you said, from one area to another, one network to another. That is not the case on most of this maritime environment, whether it be on ships or on offshore or even at ports at times. And so when you get into this, these networks, we find them quite flat. Is that something you're finding as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Every single host is able to talk to every single other host, you know, and most of the control plane for, you know, a lot of the PLCs or the logic controllers and stuff like that, they're all able to communicate with one another if they're using Ethernet. And so a lot of the, you know, segmentation even for that, like I've been able to defeat VLANs or their virtual LAN, like their way to take a physical cable and cut it into three different networks that they are, you know, not supposed to be able to talk to each other. But if you're able to grab a MAC address from one of the devices, you know, say, for example, if you happen to, you know, come across one of their vendor lists, or if you brute force, you know, the actual MAC address on the computer, which is like, it's basically its fingerprint or its, you know, social security number for that device, you're able to find that device specifically on that VLAN. You can do what are called VLAN hopping, which is another way to get into a pivot into a different network. And on several of the occasions, you know, their voice VLANs, I was able to travel through that voice VLAN. It has something called QoS or quality of service. So I was able to hop on that voice VLAN, go right into the industrial control network. And then at that point I was able to, you know, use default passwords. I was able to, you know, start attacking machines and things along those lines. So
let's get into that. So, okay. So to summarize what that was, so you get in there and you're using all these different types of, networks. They may have tried to separate them out, mm-hmm. but then you can hop from one to the other. When you said brute force, that's just shorthand for we're going to try different combinations until we get that right address for that right device. You pop onto that thing and you can use it to jump to others. So you're getting in there and you're jumping and you're banging around to different areas. You take control of these different areas, you're inside, and then you mentioned default passwords, which is another big area that we see as a problem. So when you get into this industrial side, a number of the components or the things that bad guys can get after, the systems and the devices and those types of things, come with a password from the actual OEM or the, you know, the when they got delivered, and no one ever changed them. And they're always the same, and you can easily pick them up. So once you get into this environment, you're not trying to fool a person for it. You're just looking up what it came with. And now you have access to that device because you used a default password that no one ever changed.
Exactly. And there are some older methods, like back in Windows XP, you know, they have, you know, without getting too technical, they used to use like a very weak method of encrypting passwords called NTLM. And with a lot of those, you can brute force, once again, you know, trying random pass or, you know, hashes or, you know, what that password turns into when a computer sees it. You can try random versions. You can do billions of attempts per minute with those, with modern hardware. So if you're able to capture one of those passwords, you can, you know, use it on other devices inside the network. That's happened several times on several pen tests, like a large amount of the times. So
how about this? Now you've got in, you've got in this case the engine control, and you've got control. You've got your pieces. I have customers and tell me, hey, look, we don't have to worry about the cyber on the side because we can turn it off and do this all manually. Okay. So what I can do is I don't have to rely on these systems and all this technology, and I can navigate by, I don't know, stars, I guess. And I can, you know, by sight, and I can operate everything manually. What do you say to that as, again, from putting your black hat hacker hat on, what do you say to that one?
Yeah, sometimes that's the intended purpose, is to get people to switch over to manual stuff. Especially with, there's been two vessels, or one of them was an offshore rig, one was a vessel, where they thought they had complete separation for the cutouts. And we were able to prove that we would have been able to deny service to that cutoff, or that, you know, the engine stop or whatever the actual lockdowns on the ship was. So even though it was engineered properly, you know, if it doesn't have layered security on it, there always is a way where people are able to bypass that or change IDs. So when you think you're shutting this off, you're actually shutting something else off that wouldn't have been able to be shut off unless if it has the actual key, you know, from the, you know, this actual device or this actual switch. So yeah, no, it's definitely something that, yes, you know, a lot of the stuff does have, you know, physical manual switchovers, but I've seen several instances where they were improperly, or, you know, they had some sort of tie into them, or they still relied on network connectivity or things along those lines.
So. Well, that's an excellent point. So part of it is what you're saying, like, maybe that's my intent. If my intent was to slow you down, there's no way you can operate manually as fast as you can do an automated. So I've just got my target. Some of it is you're not as manual as you think. And I've had customers tell me the same thing. Oh, we can shut everything off except for, of course, our engines. But aside from that, I'm like, well, aside from what? and then the other piece is we often tell them is, listen, you're now playing a game of draw. So they call it a kill switch, you know, to be able to switch it over to manual. And the question then is, can I do my damage before you hit your kill switch? We're going to turn this into a game, and I operate in milliseconds. So how fast can you push that button and switch that over? If I've already cut off your engine and took control and put the things before you even know that you had a problem, your kill switch ain't going to help you all that much. Mm-hmm. And so there are different aspects of when we hear the kill switch concept that we say, and that obviously is going to change over time. So how do you see this, the attack surface? How do you see this concept of getting in and being able to bang around from, again, a hacker's perspective, changing over, let's say, the next, I don't know, 5 years?
Well, especially with a lot of the, after the tech boom, if you remember the dot-com boom, there was tons of programmers that lost their jobs when all these companies went up. And if you look on the map for, you know, when the dot-com era ended and the, you know, professional production of malware, it's something where it literally shot through the roof. And now with COVID going on and a lot of the other stuff, you know, there are a lot of businesses that, you know, went through a boom, you know, where they're producing thousands of, you know, hundreds of thousands of devices. And now you're going to have out of work employees that have access to development kits, things along those lines that was never accessible. So, yeah, I would say within the next 3 or 4 years, you know, you're going to see that same uptick. And we actually have seen it on the, you know, banking sector and some of the other sectors, industries, is a lot of these people who are laid off, especially in, you know, countries outside the United States, a lot of them will more apt to turn to crime and things like that. So, and professionally developed, like some of the actual crypto lockers and, you know, the software as a service for, you know, encryption, they handle all your payments. They have 24-hour technical support. It's, you know, it's gotten better than most of the VARs or, you know, the actual resellers, you know, for as far as technical support. So it's just a crazy attack surface and exploits. You know, one of the last exploits that I came up with, I turned it over to CERT, which is Computer Emergency Response Team. They're like the police of the internet, kind of. And they told me that if I would have wanted to, if I would have been a bad guy, I could have sold that exploit for, you know, close to $500,000. So. Yeah, there's, well, definitely money in it.
That's a really interesting piece, because people think hackers, aside from, again, nation states and some of these other ones, aren't necessarily that professional. But if you look at the dark web, if you look at where they're actually developing their businesses, these get to be fairly well-run machines with human resource departments and all the different types of parts of an organization. They just do it on the opposite side, the dark side. And you can sell an exploit. So let's say you find one. You don't have to be the one who actually uses it. You go into one of these marketplaces online, dark reaches of the net, and you sell it. And someone says, oh, or you have an exploit into a place. Hey, I have access to this spot. I've already done the exploit. I don't just need a kit or code. I'm already in. Who wants to get into this spot? And it becomes its own marketplace. Heck, with ransomware, as you said, they've got customer service departments helping people figure out how to make their payments on ransomware. Meaning, if you don't know how to do Bitcoin, just, you know, 1-800, you're robbing me, and they'll be happy to walk you through how to pay them. So it's growing in its formality, as also connectivity is growing. So you have these different factors that are igniting it. So you've got Well, as you said, you get something like an economic crisis, a global economic crisis, which we have going on. You're getting people out of work and who feel that they need. So you're getting an uptick in the supply, if you will, of the folks. You are getting an uptick in the type of connectivity out there, because connectivity, of course, never decreases. It's only increasing. So now the opportunity is going up. And then its own professionalism is also accelerating and within that market. So you get these different types of factors going in. Do you we usually see it as the bad guys are still learning, by and large, this environment. Obviously, you focus on it and you try to help people get ahead of it. Mm-hmm. But the concept is, we've seen is, hackers always fill the space, right? Black hat hackers. Bad actors will fill a new space. The new space is operational technology, and a new space is in maritime. These are opportunities that you can go over. So it is a matter of time, and they're adapting more quickly than the industry is evolving. Is the philosophy. Is that something that you're finding out there as far as that desynchronization of, well, you know, how fast they're moving versus how people are adapting or they're evolving themselves?
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that, you know, especially several companies are very far behind on, you know, bug disclosure programs. Like, the reason that I called CERT, or that computer emergency response team, is because the company, if I literally would have approached them and honestly just wanted to turn over the exploit, they would have sued me. They would have sent me a cease and desist letter. They would have sued me for millions of dollars that they never would have gotten.
Right.
But they're known as a very sue happy company. So it's something where people don't even want to approach them. I've gotten several cease and desist letters from my DEF CON talks that I've done from, you know, lots of manufacturers and providers and stuff like that. And it's something where we do what's called a vulnerability or a responsible disclosure. So, like, before we even talk about it or release it publicly, we'll, you know, let the vendors, or actually work with them to actually fix it. And there's tons of vendors that are awesome about it, like you know, lots of the phone manufacturers from my DEF CON talks, and you know, a lot of the baseband software providers. Like, they're all really, really awesome. They, you know, we literally had, you know, 14-hour conversations, you know, over a week's period on, like, just ways of methods to improve some of it. So, but with some of the companies, they see it as a violation because I reverse engineered source code, or, you know, and things like that. And like I said, if I would have been a less honest person, I could have made, you know, in that instance, it was $500,000. That was a remote code execution that would have worked on a thing called a session border control. And that would have affected, you know, probably 70% of the voice traffic. So people wouldn't have been able to listen to pretty much phone calls. They would have been able to get into these telecom networks and things like that. And they should just need to make it easier for people to be able to disclose those kind of vulnerabilities. So,
well, and that's it, right. I think as an industry, I mean, I'm coming from power and gas. I'm coming from other places that are, and then previous to that on the IT side, you know, in the Intel community, and then off to financial services, they're more used to it. Maritime is, this is new, and you have to appreciate that a lot of the people who are running these organizations are engineers, and engineers like two things. They like predictability and they like repeatability. These are two things that cyber is not. And so you're getting a difference of saying, this world is changing. I haven't necessarily felt the specific bite in my organization. So there's a little bit of a denial, or, gee, it won't happen to me. As it's going, and quite frankly, the adversaries are learning that environment. They don't know exactly how to attack it. I mean, they're figuring it out. As you can tell, there are connectivities, there are ways to get in, and again, it's just like it's an empty space. It will be filled.
Oh, yeah.
The idea is, how do you get into that? How do you get ahead of that? And as you're saying, how do you communicate between each other? How do we know that if there's an exploit or attack, and you've seen this and you can speak to this, I'm sure, far deeper than I can, but when an attacker has one successful attack in one environment, they will keep trying that in every other environment, and they will usually publicize it to their other 100%. Communities. And so you want that threat intelligence that says, gee, that, you know, I got hit by this, so can everyone know that I got hit like this, so that you can duck, you know, you can protect yourself.
Yeah.
And another, that just doesn't work in maritime.
Oh, yeah. And another thing, like, if you look on the availability of equipment. So like about a week and a half ago, I found a controller for actual 747, which is, you know, like a classified, you know, if you know how to like ARINC 429 is like the CAN or the controller network for an aircraft. And you can buy those on eBay now.
Man.
So how long till somebody, you know, buys it on eBay, you know, ships it over to Ukraine or, you know, even keeps it in the States and just does a lot of research on it. The same with vessels, you know, especially when people get let go or they had, you know, a couple, you know, these prototype Allen Bradley PLCs or, you know, these, you know, ship control devices or things like that. Or if they know like, hey, this ship's getting shut down, you guys are just automatically losing the job. Sometimes people walk off with stuff and a lot of it ends up on these online marketplaces. That was one of the, you know, risk analysis I did for one of my talks I did a couple of years ago was how, you know, a traffic control system is stolen. You know, that's a industrial control device. Also, somebody steals it from, you know, some corner, you know, in the middle of downtown Boston or something. And then all of a sudden they're, you know, finding these vulnerabilities. And it's not that, you know, these systems are hardened even remotely. It's just that nobody has $400,000 to buy, you know, this, that, and the other stuff, or even, you know, $5,500. But when you start getting into some of these nation states and, you know, well-funded researchers, even like a lot of these pen testing companies, they'll like to get a little bit of clout and publicity. So they'll find, you know, they'll buy these controllers and stuff like that. And they'll find these vulnerabilities, some of them just to get in the news. But some of them genuinely want to, you know, improve the security of the environment. So as more and more of those devices show up, you're going to have a heyday of actual exploits on the market.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And as you're getting in there and you're getting more connected devices and IoT and those pieces, there's going to be more in secondary markets. And there's going to be more things when you do decommissioning. And there's going to be more things when you're putting in the ones they didn't use and sitting at warehouses and et cetera. So more connected pieces mean more connected devices, which means more opportunities to study said devices and figure out what you can do, you know, nefariously on board. So these pieces are coming. One of the big things questions I get is, can you point to where OT cyber or industrial cyber on vessels have been attacked? I know from our side, it's not something we obviously publicly talk about with our customer base. We can say, yes, we've seen and do that. Is that something aside from your penetration testing that you guys can attest to that it's out there? It's not a theory.
A couple industrial control environments that I've seen previous to working where I have now, I had to actually stop what I was doing because I didn't want to forensically damage stuff. And So
what you mean is you're going in for the pen test and you tripped over actual bad guy and you stopped and said, hey guys, maybe you should take care of this before I continue with my test.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which,
yeah, like I said, in different industries, train industries.
And they are. And you look at adjacent industries. Again, this is the same kind of thing we're seeing in oil and gas. You're seeing this in you know, power generation. One of the things we look at is, you know, the ecosystems of this. You know, if you have an oil field in a port and an offshore drilling and your actual transportation during maritime, that's a full ecosystem. A lot of times organizations will just see the one part. Oh, we'll just protect this piece because that's the part that we know. But it's all connected. It's all one large ecosystem as you come in. And that's, you have to understand that. Within one organization. And then of course you get to ports and they're just always getting connections in and out and in and out and in and out. So if they're not having their pieces, they could be spreaders of these types of attacks and malware.
Oh yeah. And exactly. And supply chain attacks is another one. Like if you look over the years, how many devices have been bought, modified, you know, they've had it happen with point of sale systems. They've had PLCs that have had this happen, network gear, several of the ships I've been on, I asked them, where'd you get that printer at? And, you know, it was at a street market in Malaysia. You know, I'm guessing they have, you know, the firmware is up to date on that one. So,
yeah. Right. Right. And that's how you're trying to get in. And again, aftermarket purchases, other pieces coming in these elements. So, all right. So as you look forward, we said, you know, how this is changing over, what would you say, what would you recommend, you know, if you got someone who says, all right, I'm an owner or a manager and I want to do something about us. What are some of the things that they can just do now? Or what would you recommend them to do to start doing that kind of cyber hygiene that is required?
Definitely the first things they can do is finding out what is all on their network. That's stuff that doesn't require an expert as long as you have the network technicians on staff. I've had several times when I was on a pen test, I was like, hey, what's this? They had no idea. And it was like, you know, somebody had brought an Apple TV and plugged it in for, you know, once a quarter they watch movies while they're doing their end of year stuff or, you know, or things like that. And just know what's on your network. Have a good inventory of what is collected. You can always do more network diagrams and things like that, and having them all planned out. Making sure that your segmentation is, you know, up to snuff and, you know, following the best practices from providers. Most of the, you know, actual manufacturers, they'll provide, you know, the best way to configure their own stuff, and taking into consideration those things change over time, definitely keeping up on that. So.
All right. No, that's good. And I'd add training of your people as a basic sort of blocking and tackling piece on it. Understand the vendors, vendor risk management, or the third parties coming aboard, what they're doing, what they're bringing on board, how things get updated, you know, on that. Obviously, there's vulnerability management you can do, but I'm just talking about even before that. Just know who and what is touching your system and why and when.
Exactly. And a really good, like, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure type situation with,
oh yeah.
Yeah. With cybersecurity training, there's so many either free courses, or they have even, you know, company wide courses that are very affordable, you know, $1,000, $2,000, where everybody can go through them and they'll watch the videos, do a little test and stuff like that. So, and spear phishing emails, you know, make sure you're doing your internal spear phishing. If that's one of the largest attack factors. You look at, you know, the last 7 years, you know, what the most common, you know, entry point into it was some sort of social engineering, like that recent Twitter hack, you know, with getting a hold of some of the, you know, vendor-based tools or third-party tools or internal tools, you know, it all starts with spear phishing in some cases or some sort of insider threat. So.
All right. Well, thank you. This has been phenomenal. Is there any last words you would have, advice or concepts or things you'd want to convey to folks?
Oh yeah, just patch your systems, and yeah, just keeping track of, you know, what is actually out there for vulnerabilities for your systems. So, because there's several people that have come across that they didn't even realize that, you know, something that happened 6 years ago, wireless stuff is a huge example of it. I've used an attack from 2016 to literally get on probably 50% of my vessels that I've ended up doing full compromises. And I believe majority of them, we've done all of them full compromise. So it's something where, you know, if they would have just simply patched, you know, it's that chain of attack. It's not necessarily one bad thing. It's, you know, three bad things that lead to a terrible situation. So,
yeah. A system can handle one. They can't handle three.
Exactly.
Points of failure. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for your time today and your insights. This has been very, very enlightening and very helpful.
I appreciate that.